All right. We made it through Matthew 24 yesterday. Dealt with the whole rapture thing, but we need to, and we started with going through two out of the last four parables that will end the final major discourse. So, we are in Matthew chapter 25, verse 14. So far, what has been the emphasis from verse 36 on? Two things in particular. This is how we started off yesterday. I want to make sure we're on the same page again today. Two major emphasis are going on from verse 36 on. What are they?
The second coming,
being prepared for it, exactly. That be on watch, and what else? The destruction of the temple is the first 35 verses, but with the second coming, there's an exhortation to ethically be in control. What is the second thing though that is emphasized throughout the second coming talk? You don't know when it's going to happen, right? You don't know when it's going to happen because there's going to be a significant delay. There's not going to be any signs. You just need to be ready. That's the emphasis as we're going through these. So the first two parables emphasize that. You have the parable of the wicked servant who's like, hey, my master's been gone for a little while, so maybe I should just start beating all the other servants and hanging out with the drunkards. So he does that. Master comes back. It's not a good situation at that point for the wicked servant. Then you have the parable of the 10 virgins. Five of them had their oil lamps ready to go. Five of them were taking a nap. And whenever they realized it's time for the bridegroom, they ran to go get more oil and they didn't have enough and they were left outside. Because the point is, at the very end of verse 13 in chapter 25, keep watch. Because you don't know the day or the hour. You don't know. Now, does keep watch mean stare at the sky or just stare at the newspapers and make sure that you're keeping a close tab on the rapture index? Because there is one online, by the way. Is that what he's saying, to keep watch? No, what is he saying? What is keep watch saying to the Christian?
Just be ready at all times.
Be ready. Ethically, be ready. Justice, mercy, and faithfulness. The fourth parable is going to be hammering that home. It's going to clearly define how we are to keep watch, how we are to be ready. So let's deal with parable number 3, chapter 25, verse 14. It says, again. Now what does that one word tell me? What? Yeah. It's going to be saying the same thing as the last two, just from a different angle. We call this in scholarly language recapitulation. He's recapitulating the same point, saying it over and over from a different angle for emphasis. Okay? So again, he says, it will be like a man going, what is it? It will be like, but what is it? The second coming will be like the coming of the Son of Man at the end of the age, at the soon tell ya. It will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. Okay, no, wait a minute. Let me stop right there. Each according to his ability. Nah, we're not going to talk about that. That's dumb. Then he went on his journey. Verse 16, the man who had received his 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. How many does he have? Huh, what does that maybe possibly indicate? His works are what? Complete. So also the one with 2 talents gained 2 more. How many does he have? And what does 4 also stand for? Completeness. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, what is that indicating? What? Yes. That Jesus says consistently that the second coming has a significant delay. It's not going to happen right after the destruction of the temple. It's going to be a long time. As a matter of fact, this is the third time he's emphasized this in these four parables, right? He keeps saying over and over, the master was gone for quite a long time. Right here, once again, the master is gone. After a long time, the master is going to come back. The master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received the 5 talents brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 talents. See, I have gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Now keep that in mind, because in your mind right now, you're trying to apply this parable, but usually we misapply it. Usually we misapply this because we ignore the context. More than any other parable that I can think of, this one is always pulled out and applied to weird situations. It even happened earlier this semester with someone on our campus that was speaking about this particular issue. Totally misapplied this parable. I won't give any more vague details than that. But verse 23, his master replied, oh, did I already read that one? No. Verse 22, the man with 2 talents also came. Master, he said, you entrust me with 2 talents. See, I have gained 2 more. Notice, there's a parallel structure, right? First one comes, presents what he was given, and then presents what he was in, or what he was entrusted with. Then he presents what he gained. Same thing with the second one. And the response by the master is going to be parallel as well. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. How is this passage normally applied to your life? How is it applied? It's okay. I'm not saying that you believe this. I'm just saying, tell me how you normally hear this applied to your life.
If you're faithful with the small things that God's given you now, then He's going to give you more.
Yeah. Yeah, that's usually what it is. And usually what people will do is they'll bring in, you know, some people have been given more. And they will, you know, they'll be given even more if they're faithful with what they've been given. You know, according to their abilities. Part of that is true. The responsibility of what God has given you and the way that He has entrusted you and how you deal with that, part of that is true. In other words, let's add this into the salvific equation. He really is going to look at you and judge you in some sense with what you do. Will what you do earn your salvation? No. Jesus earns your salvation. But whenever you are in Jesus, you're supposed to do stuff. It's just bogus to think that you're not. And we'll talk about that even more in depth here in a minute, because that's going to be a key point of the next parable. But that is a part of the application. However, in context, when do they receive more responsibility? Second coming. Right? After the master comes, that's whenever he gives them more. Right? Isn't that, am I misreading that? Give me a nod, even if you disagree. Just, this is second coming talk, right? What we normally do is we rip it out and we apply it to now, so that we can convince ourselves that if we are just like faithful with our small things, then God's going to bless us really big here on earth. If I'm really good in my small church, then He's going to give me a mega church. That's how we usually apply this, don't we? That's not what it's saying. What it's saying is this: you're faithful in the small church, even if you never get a mega church. You go where I tell you to go. You do what I tell you to do. And trust me, when you get on the flip side, you'll be taken care of. Both of them are going to say, hey, come, enjoy your master's happiness. Do I believe there are rewards in heaven? Yeah. I do. Because 10 talents is bigger than 4, but in the context of the second coming. I'm sorry, I'm a context guy. I refuse to pull it out. It's the way I roll. So you don't have to agree with me. I'm down. But it's just the way it's going to be. Yeah. Here's the key issue, though. The third servant is the key issue. The whole parable, a lot of times we focus on the first two. The application is in the third one. The third character in this story is what we need to focus on to get the message of this parable. So let's keep reading. Verse 24, then the man who had received the 1 talent came. Master, he said, I knew that you are a hard man. Harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. In other words, you're a stinking thief. I knew that. I knew you're a mean guy, really a jerk, and that you steal stuff because you harvest where you didn't sow and, you know, all that fun stuff. So I was afraid of you and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here, it belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. Ooh. You'd almost feel more comfortable if he just said wicked servant. He throws in that lazy thing. Here, let me say this very clearly. And there's some of you that really need to hear this very clearly. Laziness is a sin in the kingdom of God. It is. Some of you need to get your act together when it comes to getting stuff done and being responsible and doing it on time. Because frankly, you're just being lazy. And if you think that won't carry over into your kingdom work, you're kidding yourself. You're kidding yourself. You want to be a good minister? Work your butt off all the time. Am I saying kill your family? No, because that's your first ministry. If God chooses that you're married. But my word, one of the key problems that we have is people think they abuse the Sabbath. Laziness will be something that God looks at as wicked. It just is. And there's an element of this where, listen, hey, I at times I will talk about this in a pastoral voice, and at other times I'll talk about it with a little bit more of a rebuking voice. There's a part of this that just says, you need to grow up and realize everyone's got a lot of stinking stuff to do. Don't act like that you're the only one with a lot of stuff to do. Just put your head down and do it. Because man, complaining just wastes your time and brings everyone else around you down. Now, if you come and complain to me, I'm going to love on you. But from up here, I'm trying to give you a little bit of an exhortation right now. You know what? Bottom line is, with most people, you don't want to compare schedules with them. But I was talking to somebody the other day. You know what the reality is? Stress is difficult for everyone because it's their stress. Everybody's stressed. And you know, it's like if I grabbed my list and gave it to you, you'd be like, oh, I don't want to carry that. But you know what? I wouldn't want to carry yours either. Why? Because it's yours. That's why it stresses you out. Other people's list may look bigger than yours, but it's really not the point. Because stress is relative. It's always big when it's closest to you. So let's just all say, hey, we're stressed out. We got a lot on our plates. So let's all just put our heads down and do it instead of whining about it. Because laziness is a sin. It is a flat-out sin. And some of you don't have poor grades because you're dumb. You're smart. You have poor grades because you're lazy. And that's just the truth. You need to stare yourself in the mirror and ask yourself, are you committing this sin or not? And if you're not, good. Then just keep on. But if you are, you need to get over it. Because there's bigger things at stake than your comfortability. Quit being lazy. Quit being a lazy servant. See, okay, see that one little word? Oh, bad application point, but it's there. You wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I don't sow and gather where I don't scatter my seed. He looks at him and says, oh, so you knew that. You knew I was a thief. Oh, okay, well, then you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest, you idiot. If I'm really this mean of a guy, if you're really this worried about me because you know me so well, then you should have done something that was going to give me a little bit of money. Because obviously if I'm that greedy, I'm going to be judging you by that. Right? So he's like, you want to play that game? You want me to be that person? Fine, I'll be that person. Then he moves on. Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. That's not fair. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. And throw that worthless servant out into the darkness where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Why was the wicked servant cast out into, well, hell? Why? Because he didn't know the master. A lot of times the way in which you work reflects directly the way in which you view God. Matter of fact, this is something that we'll be talking about next semester, not in this class, but in chapel, because I've already got what I'm supposed to preach on 6 months ahead, and that's not a good thing because it just keeps going over and over and over in my mind. But it's the concept of authority. The way that you respond to rules tells me a lot about the way in which you look at the people that made the rules. If you think that, you know, oh man, these rules of Ozark are so stupid, that tells me a lot about the way you look at Monty. It tells me a lot about the way you look at Matt. And the reason why is because if you really trust those people, you trust that they're actually loving you. It's the same thing with God. Man, God, you know, homosexuality is not a sin. Why would you say something like that? That's really insensitive. Or man, you know what? Fornicating is actually more fun. Jesus, maybe you just didn't know that because you were single. You know what? The way in which you rebel against God tells me a lot about the way in which you look at Him. Oh, I knew you were a hard man. You're a thief. Really? You knew that? Okay. Well, then I will judge you based on how you knew me. He is cast out because he doesn't know his master. A lot of the way in which you interact with God by the things that you do tells me a lot about the way you look at God, which is a very self-condemning thing to actually look at. That's a difficult thing for even me to say out loud. Because there's times I turn God into a taskmaster. Actually, not times, a lot of the time. And I'm wrestling through that even right now. Is that the way that I've been going past the past couple of months is as if God's waiting to flip me in the head as soon as I walk out of line. Is that really the God that I'm serving? There's nothing more that makes me upset whenever I'm interacting with someone than whenever they mischaracterize who I am. You know what I mean? When somebody's like, oh yeah, that's Shane. You know, he's this arrogant hippie that just loves the earth more than he loves Jesus. Oh, so you know me. You think that the only reason why I talk about the poor and stuff is because I'm pushing a liberal agenda and not a Jesus one. Oh, okay. That's fair. It's so annoying when people say they know who you are and then mischaracterize you completely. Isn't it? Have you been there? No? Am I the only one? God's saying this. You want to follow me? Know me. It's very simple. And if you know me, you'll know who you are. And if you know who you are, you'll know what to do. You won't have to question that. Because if you know God, you know where His heart's beating, right? And if you know what His heart is beating, then you'll know where to go and you'll know what to do. But oftentimes we act like we don't know what to do because we don't even know who He is. Or we do know who He is and we just don't want Him to be that way. Verse 31. Oh, sorry that these parables are so brutal this morning, but they are what they are. When the Son of Man comes in His glory, and all of His angels with Him, He will sit on His throne in heavenly glory. All the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. Where are we right now? Judgment, the same place we've been in all four parables. Second coming, right? Second coming. He will put the sheep on His right and the goats on His left. That sounds familiar. The right hand of the one in authority is always the most prominent position. The left in this context is negative completely. It's not always negative, the left hand of the king. Remember, because the sons of Zebedee wanted to sit at the right and the left hand of Jesus when He moved into His glory. Right? It's not always negative, but it is always inferior to the right hand. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance. What is their inheritance? The kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. Why do they get it? For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. I mean, does he have to get any more clear? I mean, it really, this Christian walk thing, life thing, is actually pretty simple. He lays it out. I mean, he gives us 5-6 things that, you know, he really is looking toward and desire. What do those things describe? The more important things of the law, Matthew chapter 23, verse 23. Justice, mercy, and faithfulness. It's very simple to recognize. But it's not simple to do. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you? Or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you as a stranger and invite you in or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? What is odd about this? What is odd about this? They're shocked. The good ones are shocked. They're going, what? When did we do that for you? I mean, don't get me wrong, that's cool, man. I want the inheritance, but when did we feed you? When did we clothe you? When did we go to the prison? I don't even remember. And he looks at him and he's like, well, I tell you the truth, whatever you did to one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. Here is what is amazing about this parable. It shocks them because it's so much about who they are. They're probably not even shocked that they didn't see Jesus. They're probably shocked because they're going, really? That's what you're so excited about? I mean, that was just a part of our daily rhythm. That's just what we did. Why is that so shocking, Jesus? Or why is that so amazing? I mean, that's just what you do when you're a Christian. He's like, but you don't understand. When you're doing that stuff, you're doing it to me. You're doing it to me. And then he looks at the other servants. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me. They will also answer. They will also answer. Same thing. Lord, when did we see you hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or needing clothes, or sick, or in prison, and did not help you? When? When were you there? Because if you were there, we would have done it. He replied, I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for the least of these, you didn't do for me. Because you don't understand who I am. See, it all goes back to an identity issue. Who was Jesus and what did he do? That's my Christian life class in a nutshell. You don't even ever have to take it. My whole class is just simply, who is Jesus? What did he do? Let's do that. That's it. But if you do start doing that and talking like that, you will understand how hanging on a tree makes sense. Because people don't want you to do that. Is that an overstatement? Not at all. Not at all. Then they will go to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. Here's what I want to say about this. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8 is very, very clear and very right. You are saved by grace through faith. Not by works of your own, but by Jesus, so that no one can boast. And yet, verse 10 of Ephesians 2 says, You are Christ's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for what purpose? To do good works. I'm so sick and tired of Christians using this "we don't work our way into salvation" as a justification for them to be lazy, wicked servants. For them to sit on their butts and to do nothing for anybody but themselves. For ministers to say, "Well, I'm not going to go out to the homeless because that's not in my job description." Yes, it is. Every one of you. Yes, it is. This is not a gift issue. This is an identity issue. This isn't how God has made you to be or the passions He's given you. This is a mission issue. Sorry. He makes it very clear what He desires. And for us to act like that feeding the least of these and clothing the least of these and visiting those in prison, the least of these, is just something that you can choose to do at a whim, is to not understand who He is and what He's established. Period. This is how He ends the fifth major discourse. This is the last major thing He says. Is it important? What He's saying is, I want you to start loving on the people that characterize the Beatitudes. Remember those people? Love them. Why? Because they're going to inherit the kingdom of heaven. It's just not an option, this whole social justice stuff. It's just not an option. It's not an issue to debate. It's not a theological topic that we get to banter. It defines who we are. That's who we are. We are the people that love the least of these better than anybody else in the world. That's what we always were known for. Always. How do we love them? We feed them. We clothe them. We give them both water and living water. We give them what the world can't offer them. It just doesn't get any more clear than this. I mean, whenever James says a pure and false religion is one that looks after orphans and widows, I mean, like, what else? Tell me, if you are going to make loving people one of the modus operandi of your people, what statement would you want it to be the most clear? I can't find anyone more clear than what's already been said. I mean, whenever 1 John chapter 4, 20 through 21, whoever says he loves God whom he cannot see, but doesn't love his brother whom he can see, is a liar, John says. He is a liar. For he cannot claim to love what he cannot see when he doesn't even love what he sees. He says, "For we have been given this command, whoever loves God must love his neighbor." How much more clear do you want him to be? Basically, the reason why we act like it's not clear is because we just don't want to do it. And if we're just being honest, we just don't want to do it. Verse chapter 26. When Jesus finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples. Okay, first of all, when Jesus had finished saying all these things, what does that tell me? Yes, the fifth major discourse has just ended. That's what happens at the end of every single major discourse. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, "As you know, the Passover is 2 days away and the Son of Man..." Stop right there. If you're a Jew, what did he just say? The Passover is in 2 days and the Son of Man. Whoa. What would you be thinking? Oh, buddy, the Exodus is coming. Because what's the Passover celebrate? The Exodus, liberation. The overthrow, the casting off of the yoke of the oppressors. Passover that first was implemented in the 10th plague of the Exodus, yeah? That's in 2 days, Jesus says. And the Son of Man, what does that say? King! So what happens next? What he says next would have shocked him again. We see that it shocks him again once we start reading the rest of this chapter. God love them. They're just so confused. And the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified. Silly Jesus. Crucifixions for non-messiahs. Then the chief priest and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and they plotted to arrest Jesus in some sly way and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or there may be a riot among the people. Caiaphas was put into place by the Roman Empire as the high priest of Israel in AD 18. He's the son-in-law of Annas, who was the previous high priest. We see them both kind of playing significant roles, not necessarily throughout just the Gospels, but throughout the New Testament. Caiaphas, though, is the high priest right now, and he is Rome's puppet. They're all hanging out at the palace where Caiaphas is at, and what are they trying to figure out? How they can get their stinking honor back. Because this Jesus guy has ripped it away from them time and time again. And they're sort of thinking, should we go argue with him? No, probably shouldn't do that because that hasn't turned out so well. Should we try to set a trap for him that maybe he'll fall into? No, he always seems to bypass those and it snaps on my foot instead. Best option, let's kill him. The reason why that is a key option for them is because Matthew chapter 11 verse 12 tells us very clearly the way in which they progress their kingdom. For the kingdom has been progressing, it says in Matthew 11, 12, violently through the actions of violent men who have laid hold of it. They don't know any other way to progress their kingdom after they've tried their seditious acts of trapping him and trying to out-argue him. The only other option they have to progress their kingdom is violence, to kill him. That's all they've got. And so that's what they try to do. But they're still playing the political game. See, they realize Matthew chapter 21 wasn't a fluke. That when Jesus came in, all the people were heralding him as Hosanna, the son of David, the king has come. So if they go and just arrest him and try and kill him in public, that could cause a riot. They're worried about their political position. They're worried about their political places of power. They want to regain honor, not lose it to a riot. So they've got to figure out a sly way, you know. Innocent as a dove, sly as a serpent, something like that. Anyway, not necessarily innocent though. Anyway, okay. Verse 6, while Jesus was in Bethany in the home of a man known as Simon the leper, what's interesting about that is that we really don't know much about Simon the leper. The only other place where his name even appears is Matthew or Mark chapter 14 verse 3, and it's the parallel passage for this account. So it really didn't help me much. All I really know about him is what? He was an outcast. He was known as Simon the leper. That's not something you want at the end of your name. John the baptizer, that's not bad. You know, Jesus, you know, of Nazareth, not too good, but hey, it's good enough. Simon the leper, no, it's not going to get you any jobs anytime soon. I'll tell you that right now. Simon the leper. So he goes there. A woman came to him with an expensive... Well, first of all, let me say this, though. Why does... Because this is the question that you were asking in your exegetical papers. Why does Matthew put verses 3 and through 5 right before verses 6 and following? Why? What is he doing? Because what we'd have at the very beginning in verses 1 and 2 is you have Jesus that says this proclamation of his death. Then all of a sudden we jump locations over here to where Caiaphas is with all of his people in his palace. Then we jump back over here. Why does he do that? What is he doing? He's narrating the events. That is definitely one of the reasons why he's got him there. But why does he narrate it like that? What is he doing with this group that's gathering in Caiaphas' palace and this group that's now gathering in Simon the leper's house? What is he doing to him? Paralleling. Yeah, he's contrasting them. He's saying, look at the kingdoms. Check them out. This kingdom gathers together in a palace. Reminds me of Matthew chapter 11. What did you go out into the desert to see? A king dressed in fine clothes that has a really nice fancy palace? They gather in a palace, and who are they hanging out with? The elite. The high priest Caiaphas. We rub elbows with only the best. And what are they trying to do? Figure out a way to kill Jesus. And then we have this kingdom, who goes and hangs out with Simon the leper. That's their Caiaphas. They're going to hang out with the guy that's known for being an outcast. And they're going to hang out in his house, not a palace, his house, which probably at one point was even condemned because he was a leper. And what are they talking about? How Jesus is going to win by getting killed. The kingdoms are on play. Sorry, am I boring someone? I apologize. The kingdom is on display. You see what's happening? The two groups, the reason why Matthew does this, he's setting the two groups next to each other and he's saying, look at the difference. Look at the difference. It's marked, the difference. Okay. A woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which she poured on his head as he was reclining at the table. Notice a couple of things. Number one, Matthew never tells us the name of the woman. And he never tells us even how much this perfume cost. Doesn't tell us. John, on the other hand, does. John chapter 12 tells us very clearly, number one, 12 verse 3 tells us this is Mary, Lazarus' sister. He tells us. This is Mary. You know, Martha's sister, Lazarus' sister, Mary. More than likely, what she is taking, the perfume that she has, the alabaster jar, was probably something they had bought because her brother had died. And they were going to anoint him with this expensive perfume because even though it cost a lot of money, which John tells us it cost a year's wage, means 365 denarii, which is pretty expensive. Even though it cost that much, it was worth it because it brought honor to their dead brother. But what happened to Lazarus in chapter 11 of John? Had Jesus raised him from the dead, and so the perfume was not needed anymore. So instead, she goes and tries to anoint Jesus with it. But keep this in mind. I've given you the details, but keep this in mind. Matthew doesn't. That is significant. Matthew does not give us the details. And we're going to keep asking the question, why? Because he bypasses a couple more details. And I think he's doing it for a reason. When the disciples saw this, they were indignant. Why this waste, they asked. This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor. First of all, let me say this. He omits two key details. Two key details. Number one, he doesn't tell us who said this. Does he? John does. And who does John tell us that said this? Judas. And he doesn't tell us why they said this. But John does. Why does John say that Judas said this? Because he was the treasurer of the group and he liked to take a little bit off the top for himself. Good tax collector. Even though he was a zealot. Anyway. But notice, those details are not in Matthew. Instead, let's ask, in Matthew, this really would have been a logical objection, right? What was the very last parable that Jesus just told them? What did he just tell them? What did he just talk to them about? Care for the least of these. And this woman takes this perfume that could have done a lot of damage for the least of these. Right? And she does what she do? She dumps it on his head. And they're going, hold on, why this waste? We could have sold this and give it to the poor. What I'm saying is this. Partially, the disciples are right. Partially. For the first time in the Gospel of Matthew, the disciples, for the first time, somewhat show a glimmer of getting the right lens of the kingdom. Because they understand that what Jesus said a lot about was about loving the least of these. And this is not an act that matches up with that. But there is one key detail that they're fighting against that makes their view still skewed. We're going to see what that is. Aware of this, Jesus said to them, why are you bothering this woman? Because she's acting like a goat. That's why. She's done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you. but you will not always have me. That verse right there is so abused. So abused. Usually, what's so ironic is that verse is usually quoted to try to show that we don't really have to worry about the poor. You don't really... I mean, come on. Really, you're going to spend all your money and all your time on the poor? I mean, you'll always have them. Jesus even said it. Don't forget when he said it. It's right after the parable of the sheep and the goats. So maybe there's something bigger going on there. Because it seems like the first 25 chapters of Matthew have been leading in a direction where it says, no, helping the poor is actually a good thing. And this one verse, we're going to overturn all of that? What would have been shocking for the disciples with that verse is not the first half of the verse, it's the last half. You will not always have me. I'm sorry, what? What? No. Of course we will. You're the king. The king's not going anywhere. The king's going to rule. Because whenever we have our foot on the throats of those enemies, you're going to be the one sitting on the throne. Of course we're going to have you. No, you won't. How did this whole section start off? Verses 1 and 2. Chapter 26. How did it start off? Huh? Jesus saying, I'm going to be crucified. Verses 3 through 5. How did that conversation continue? What were they talking about? Killing Jesus. Then we go here into this middle section. What do you think we're still going to be talking about? Killing Jesus. Because what happens right after in verse 14? Judas goes off to get ready to betray Jesus to kill him. The point of this passage is not the poor. It's not the money. It's not the betrayer, which is why Matthew leaves all those details out. Because the point's not money. It's not about how expensive the perfume is. Just know it's expensive. It's not about who did it and why they did it. It's not about who objects and why they objected. The point is this. The disciples still don't get the key central fact of the kingdom. And that is that the Messiah wins by dying. They don't get it. They're starting to understand part of the kingdom with their whole objection for the poor, but they're missing the big point. She's anointing him for burial, he says in the very next verse. And they cannot accept that fact, so they object. Wait a minute. They're missing the bigger point here. The bigger point, the most central, important point of the kingdom is not taking care of the least of these. The most central important point of the kingdom is that the king died. The king died. Because with the death of the king, it leads to his resurrection. The resurrection leads to our mission, and our mission takes care of the least of these. The least of these we don't even get to in the string of command unless he dies. They're missing the point. So whenever you hear people say the poor you always have with you as a justification for not helping out the poor, just say, please read it in context. That's not what he's saying. Of course he wants you to take care of the poor. Read just 10 verses earlier. He's pretty serious about it. Ask the goats. When she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. I tell you the truth, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. Don't you think that the tax collector would have remembered this story? Then one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and asked, what are you willing to give me? Okay, now stop right here. Before I read the rest of that verse, at this point in Matthew, we really don't have a clear indication of Judas being the bad guy. We have a glimmer of that at the end of the list in chapter 10, verses 1 through 3. Whenever it says Judas Iscariot, the one who will betray him. Although the word betray there, really not a good translation of that word. You're inserting some theology there. Really all it says is handed him over. Which could be negative, or the word is also used, same word, of me saying, I just handed over my pen. Same word. Hand it back. No, I'm just kidding. But you see what I mean? The word itself is not always in a negative context. As a matter of fact, Jesus in John chapter 11 says, what I have received, God handed over to me. Is God being negative there in the handing over to Jesus what he has received, the teachings? No. It's a word that means hand over. So really, really, unless we have theology inserted into our translation, at this point, we really don't know who's going to be the one that betrays Jesus if we're reading it for the first time. This is the first indication that Judas is the one playing the part. And I'm going to suggest over this class period and the next one that in the Gospel of Matthew, you have to hear this very clearly. Very clearly. Every word I'm about to say in this sentence is very important. In the Gospel of Matthew. Okay, you hear my parameters? In the Gospel of Matthew, Judas actually will come off as somebody that didn't intentionally do what happened. In the Gospel of Matthew. Elsewhere, very clear he was intentionally done it. In the Gospel of Matthew, we will have no mention of Satan entering Judas. In the Gospel of Matthew, you will have no indication of him having shady deals on the side. In the Gospel of Matthew, we even will have, in chapter 27, Judas repenting. The word is used. We'll talk about that when we get there. It will bother you because in the Gospel of Matthew, Peter's the one that never gets reinstituted directly. Indirectly he is, but not directly. As a matter of fact, the language that's used of Peter at the end of chapter 26 is even more harsh than the language that's going to be used against Judas. In the Gospel of Matthew. Do you hear why I keep saying that? Because you go to other texts, it's very clear Judas had very evil intentions. In the Gospel of Matthew, it doesn't seem that way. As a matter of fact, at the Lord's Supper in just a minute, which we won't get there today, but we'll get there tomorrow, Judas is going to be shocked that he is the one that is betraying Jesus. Because verses 14 through 16 for him may not, in the Gospel of Matthew, be actions of treason. We'll talk about what I think that is in just a minute. Let's keep reading this. Then one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and asked, "What are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you?" Hand him over to you, same word that theologically loaded with betray as before. Same word. If I hand him over to you. So they counted out for him 30 silver coins, which really wasn't very much. So to suggest that like he's doing this for the money is really just a misnomer. 30 pieces of silver is not that big of a deal back then. It really wasn't. So they counted out for him 30 silver coins. From then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. Same word. Here's what possibly, in the Gospel of Matthew, okay? Possibly what could be happening here is a couple of things. Number one, maybe it is, if we allow all the other Gospels to influence us with Judas at this point, maybe he is just being evil and just really wanted to be evil. In the Gospel of Matthew, that's not what it seems to be. He could be just, you know, at a mafia point where he's tired of Jesus talking about this whole dying thing and he's just like, you know what, you're clearly not the king, I'm just going to lop you off. So I'm going to hire a hitman. Actually, I'll just be the hitman and I'll just make sure you get lopped off. It's possible, but in the Gospel of Matthew, it doesn't seem that way. The third option, which I think in the Gospel of Matthew is being pushed forward, is Judas is trying to put Jesus in a position to where the kingdom can violently come onto the scene the way in which he expects it to come on the scene. In other words, I'll hand him over to you. Now what happens to you after that is not my responsibility. But I'll hand him over to you. Oh yeah, that's fine. 30 pieces of silver, whatever. I'll hand him over to you. No problem. Because whenever he comes over, what's going to happen is y'all are going to be in a big trouble. It's going to be intense. In the Gospel of Matthew, Judas is portrayed as a misguided zealot. One that thinks he's fighting for the kingdom, but he's looking at it only through the Jewish view. Only through the same view that Satan was trying to perpetuate. Only through the same view that Peter was rebuked for in chapter 16. The view that says the king must take power through violence. That's what Judas is trying to do. And ultimately, this leads to Judas killing himself because he is so distraught at what happens. We'll get to that in chapter 27, verses 3. So on that note, now that you think I'm a heretic, even though it's weird because nothing's really at stake here with that. Yeah, you're dismissed. Love you. See you in the morning. Test is on Friday, not Tom or Roe. Friday.